This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Trials of Apollo, Camp Jupiter Classified, A Probatio's Journal by Rick Riordan, read for you by Aaron Cahill. To all campers, past and present. From Reina Avila Ramirez Arellano, Praetor of the 12th Legion Fulminata. This journal has been reprinted with the author's permission at my request. It is my hope and that of my fellow praetor, Frank Zhang, that this record of one of Probatio's experiences will serve a dual purpose. First, as an introduction to Camp Jupiter for all new recruits, and second, as a valuable reminder that there are outside forces who seek to destroy our way of life. Let Claudia's story be a warning that we must be ever vigilant if we are to survive. We can never know where or when the next attack is coming, only that it is inevitable. SPQR forever! Rah-rah. Property of Claudia, Legacy of Mercury, 4th Cohort of the 12th Legion Fulminata. Day 1. I made it! Oh my gods, it's my first night in the 4th Cohort Barracks. I scored a great bunk right next to the window, and I'm writing by the light of an ancient Roman oil lamp. So cool! I want to record everything I'm feeling, everything I've seen and been through to get here, but it's lamps out now. So, until next time. 1 hour later. First item on tomorrow's to-do list? Find a store that sells earplugs. The girl in the bunk next to me snores loud enough to rattle the tiles out of a mosaic. Explains why my bed was up for grabs when I first arrived. I'm holed up in the girl's latrine now, writing because sleeping is a lost cause. As far as bathrooms go, this one's pretty awesome. Marble tile everywhere with gold-plated touches, like the hinges on the stall doors. Seeing those hinges makes me a little homesick, actually. Dad would geek out over them. I don't know why he loves restoring old hardware so much. But hey, he earns a living doing it, so no judgment. Apparently, making money is something that comes naturally to a legacy of Mercury. A legacy of Mercury? Yikes. It's still sinking in that Dad and I are descended from a Roman god and one of the 12 biggies of Olympus, no less. Especially because I knew next to nothing about my family until 2 months ago. I still don't know anything about my mom, except her name, Cardi, and what she looks like. Looked like. I found a picture of her stashed away in Dad's room. In the photo, she was maybe in her early 20s, and we have the same wavy dark hair, dark eyes, high cheekbones, and large nose. She was leaning against the frame of an open doorway, one hand resting on her stomach. I think she was pregnant then, with me. Right. Moving on. I had no clue about the Mercury connection until my 12th birthday, when Dad gave me an old scroll that showed his family's genealogy. 3 generations back, there's great-granddad, the messenger of the gods, also the god of merchants and shopkeepers, thieves and tricksters, and travelers. Wears a lot of hats, he does. All of them winged. Full disclosure, Dad. I thought you'd gone bonkers when you showed me that scroll. And when you told me about your past and my future, that, like you, one day soon I'd be summoned by the wolf goddess Lupa and brought to a crumbling old mansion in Sonoma, California, where her immortal wolf pack would train me to be a Roman soldier. I have to say this about that. Worst camp out ever. Assuming I'd passed all their tests, AKA didn't die a horrible wolf-inflicted death, I'd then trek southward through a monster-infested wilderness, second worst campout ever, to Camp Jupiter, where I'd present your letter of recommendation to whoever was in charge and hope I'd be accepted into the ranks of the 12th Legion Fulminata. Which brings me to this question. How much would it suck to go through all that and not get into a cohort? Answer, a lot. Not that new recruits need to worry about rejection these days. According to my centurion, Layla, the Legion's numbers were badly depleted last summer, Something about a war involving the primordial earth goddess Gaia, a bunch of giants, a humongous statue of the Greek goddess Athena, and a Greek demigod camp. Good news, Camp Jupiter helped save the world. Smiley face. Bad news, Camp Jupiter lost a lot of people while helping save the world. Frowny face. More bad news, something funky happened to demigod communications soon after our victory, which Layla says likely spells more trouble coming our way. Anyway, Dad, sorry I doubted you because it all went down just like you said it would. And now I'm here with my official Probatio name tag around my neck. Claudia, fourth cohort. So thank you for the heads up and for this journal. If I ever have kids, they can read about my life here so they're ready when their turns come. Well, time to head back to bed. Tomorrow I'll get my first real look at Camp Jupiter. And the first place I'll visit? Wherever they sell earplugs. Day 2. What? Things I learned today. 1. Oatmeal is not the preferred breakfast food among campers. At least that's the impression I got from the disgusted looks when the Ore delivered my bowl of it this morning. Well, to each their own, I say. 2. Bargain shopping on the Via Praetoria is easy when you're descended from the god of shopkeepers. I was on the lookout for earplugs when I spotted a toy store that sells Roman deity action figures. Mercury was front and center in the window, wearing nothing but a short toga. Now, I'm sure that look was all the rage in ancient times and the figure was pretty buff, but still, I was a little embarrassed to see many great-granddads standing there like that. Plus, something about his eyes reminded me of Dad. Anyway, I bought the doll. And I think great-granddad approved and loaned me his powers because somehow I convinced the shop owner to throw in Mercury's accessories, winged cap, winged sandals, caduceus, and tiny sack of coins for free. Short toga included, thank gods. 3. Weird things happen on Temple Hill. I learned this last lesson while checking out Mercury's temple after my delicious and nutritious breakfast. Compared to the dinky shrines of the minor gods and goddesses, great-granddad's place isn't too shabby. A rectangular structure with marble columns all around the outside, an ornate fresco above the entrance, and inside, a life-size statue of the god himself. The weird thing happened when I approached the altar. Someone had put 2 bins there in honor of Mercury's role as messenger to the gods. The bin marked outgoing was overflowing with notes, but the incoming one was empty. A sad reminder that our communications have flatlined. Still, I added a note of my own to the outbox. Just a little, hey, great-granddad, what's the word from Olympus? I was about to leave when I heard a fluttering sound. A piece of paper had appeared in the incoming bin. Written on it was the Roman numeral 12, XII, and nothing else. Now, it's possible that the note fell out of the outgoing bin, but it's equally possible that Mercury sent it. Either way, it felt important and I didn't want anyone else to find it, so I stuffed the note in my pocket and didn't give it another thought for the rest of the day. Yeah, right! That paper has been torturing me for hours! Where did it come from? What does XII mean? 12 Olympians? 12 months in a year? 12 eggs in a dozen? My age? Ugh! It doesn't matter that my roommate is snoring again and I forgot to buy earplugs. Thanks to XII, I'm not getting any sleep tonight anyway. Day 3. Ow! I once saw a t-shirt that read, "Everything hurts and I'm dying." I need one of those. That way, when someone asks how my first weapons practice went, I can just point to my chest. Because, ow. Yes, sports fans, in just one session in the Colosseum, I managed to slice my hand with a gladius and stab my thigh with a pugio. I twanged my cheek with a bowstring and pierced my foot with an arrow. Note to self, never wear sandals to weapons practice again. I launched a weird weighty dart thing called a plumbata into the stands. And as for my grand finale, I clocked my instructor in the head with the butt of my pilum when I reared back to throw. She turned it into a teachable moment about why we each wear a galia, immediately followed by a second teachable moment in which she explained galia means helmet. Later, she asked me, nicely, how I ever managed to survive Lupa's training. I told her the truth. Booby traps. I admitted that tricks like covering a pit with branches or dropping a net from the treetops on an unsuspecting enemy weren't very Roman, but they'd kept me alive. To my surprise, she pointed out that they dug trenches for the camp's war games all the time, and that a weighted net, along with a trident and dagger, were the weapons favored by the Retiarius, a type of gladiator. She promised to introduce me to the current Retiarius champion after the next gladiator games. If we hit it off, he might even let me test drive his weapons. So maybe I'm not a lost cause after all. On a less positive note, I still have no clue as to what XII means. I'll visit Mercury's temple again before classes start tomorrow. Maybe a new message has appeared. Day 4. Nice god crypt, Mars. If Mercury sent any other messages, someone else got to them first. Still, the morning wasn't a total waste. I had some time to kill before my first lecture. Great Roman inventions. Concrete. Which was actually more interesting than it sounds. Not. And taught by Vitellius, a purple-hued lar with a captivating speaking voice. Double not. So I toured a few other temples. I loved Bellona's fierce warrior vibe and Jupiter's blinged-out sanctuary. Pluto's zombie apocalypse theme, not so much. But the one that really spoke to me was the Temple of Mars Altor. I mean, who wouldn't dig that red marble crypt with its cast iron doors? And inside, that massive statue of the Avenger. No, not one of those Avengers. His scarred face scowling and his spear raised as if to strike whoever dares to enter. Let's not forget the display wall of human skulls and assorted weapons, from the kind that slice and dice to the kind that leave bullet-shaped holes. Even the ceiling pays tribute with 11 identical and bizarre-looking shields that form the letter M. That military man cave, sorry, god crypt, was built to intimidate, but the decor was so over the top. I broke into giggles while looking at it. I got out of there before I lost control, though. I'm not stupid enough to risk insulting the war god. But I'm pretty sure I insulted his son. When I came out of Mars's temple, I ran right into Praetor Frank Zhang. It was like hitting a brick wall. The guy is so solid. That should have sobered me up, but I took one look at him and started laughing all over again. I couldn't even explain what was so funny. What would I have said? Your face reminds me of how ridiculous your dad's temple is. I feel bad about it, though. I would have apologized at dinner, but Praetor Frank wasn't there. Time to go. Gotta review the recipe for Roman concrete in case there's a quiz tomorrow. Day 5. A sack full of dead rats. It was touch and go there for a moment when the centurions spun the chore wheel this afternoon. After the full-fledged legionnaires got the fun jobs, testing the catapults, taking Hannibal the elephant for a lumber, clapping chalk dust out of the erasers, I was sure it would land on sewer unclogging when it was my turn. Instead, I hit the jackpot with aqueduct cleanout. Or so I thought. Turns out, aqueduct cleanout does not mean plucking a leaf or two from the structure that ferries clean water into camp. No, it means slogging, sometimes crawling, through a maze of underground tunnels filled with ice-cold water and removing anything that isn't ice-cold water. This includes dead rats, hair of both humans and unknown origin, plastic trash bags, come on, people, reduce, reuse, recycle, remember? And other disgusting flotsam and jetsam that could contaminate our bathing and drinking supply. My partner in slime was a demigod, son of Vulcan, named Blaze. Yes, the god of forges and fire has a son named Blaze. But I didn't laugh. After all, I'm named for Emperor Claudius, who everyone believed was a fool because he stuttered and had a limp. He ended up being a decent ruler, even conquered Britain, the only emperor to do so. But still, I'm not going to get all judgy about someone else's name when mine conjures up a word like Claude. I figured Blaze and I would hang out together, chit-chat about life as a probatio, maybe sing a few rousing clean-out songs to get us in the mood. But he just grabbed his sack and his trash picker and sloshed off. I showed him, though, I trucked right after him down that tunnel and instantly got lost. Ha-ha! Being descended from the god of travelers doesn't do anything for you in underground waterways, apparently. I wandered around for an hour, shoving rat carcasses into my sack and praying my headlamp didn't go out, before I finally spotted a ladder illuminated by daylight. When I reached it, I saw that it led up to a circular opening blocked by iron bars. I figured it was either a dead end or an exit, and I definitely was ready to exit. I climbed to the top as best I could with my hands full, and the grate opened easily when I pushed it. I swung my rat bag and picker up onto the ledge and then lifted myself out of the hole, right into a big fat load of trouble that began with two metal dogs and ended with Praetor Rhaena. How was I supposed to know that ladder was a secret back entrance into the Principia? That's what I would have said if I could have, but I was too busy screaming in terror as the silver and gold dogs flew at me. Luckily, Praetor Rhaena called them off before they could rip open my throat, which allowed me the opportunity to explain that I was lost. I showed her my sack full of dead rodents as proof of my chore duty. Then I demonstrated that the grate she insisted was magically locked was, in fact, not. She had a frowny face while I was talking, but she sent me on my way with zero metal dog bites, so I guess she believed me. Either that or she wanted the dead rats out of her office. Don't know, don't care, just happy to be alive. Day 6. Bruises and baked goods. I made a friend in the fourth today. Her name is Janice, and she's the daughter of, wait for it, Janus, the two-faced god of choices, doorways, and beginnings and endings. Blaze, Janice. What is it with godly parents and their demigod kids' names? Who's next? A kid named Roman? Janice is in her second month on Probatio, but she knows a ton about Camp Jupiter because she was born and raised in New Rome. How cool is that? Man, I would have loved to have grown up there. Marble, gold, and red tile roof buildings, ginormous fountains and gardens, cobblestone streets with shops that sell togas and chariots. It's like time warping back to ancient Rome. Janice says gods and goddesses sometimes sneak down from Olympus to hang out there. Some even disguise themselves as humans and start families with retired legionnaires. I don't know if that's true, but if it is, mind blown. In fact, the only negative about New Rome might be the panhandling fauns, and they're mostly harmless hippies who like lazing in the sun, scratching themselves, and snacking on trash. I'd judge, but I eat junk food, so. I got a little sad when I saw one young faun named Elon nibbling on soda can tabs strung on a string. Not because I felt bad for him. Well, maybe a little. The kid was sitting alone next to a trash can. But mostly because the tabs reminded me of the candy necklaces Dad used to buy me when I was little. Back to Janice. We met on the field of Mars, the pockmarked boulder and rubble-strewn meadow where weekly war games among cohorts take place, during Fort Building 101. Today's assignment? Build a fort. Tomorrow's assignment, build a fort. Day after tomorrow's assignment, build a fort. My job was to construct an arched doorway. Since I aced wooden gate installation in the previous class, picked up a little hinge knowledge from watching Dad, apparently, I figured an arch would be no sweat. But the stupid stone blocks wouldn't stay in place. When they fell on me a third time, I blurted some inappropriate words. That's when this girl with wide-set eyes and long braids, Janice, yelled over, "Hey, stick a keystone in it, will ya?" I thought she was warning me to watch my language. Turns out she meant it literally, that I should fit a wedge-shaped block in the top center spot. I did, and presto, the keystone locked the other blocks in place. Instant arch. After class, I bought Janice a pastry from Bombilo's Cafe to thank her for saving me from further bodily harm. It took her forever to decide on the one to get, which I thought was hilarious since she's a daughter of the god of choices. She could have taken all day as far as I was concerned, because Bombilo's smelled so good. Just thinking about that cinnamon and sugar and vanilla and coffee odor now is making my mouth water. My merchant/shopkeeper jeans are tingling too. I know I could rake in serious dough, ha, if I could bottle up and sell that scent. Multi-purpose spritz bottles. Yes, I can smell the profits already. Double ha! Janice and I bonded over our sugar-crusted pastries while relaxing in hammocks on the fourth barracks front porch. We talked about everything from growing up as the only children of single parents, not an issue for either of us, to our near-death experiences with Lupa, very much an issue for both of us, to tomorrow's testudo, turtle, tortoise, whatever. I'm trying to use the Latin terms when I can. Practice. Only an issue if we're shoulder to shoulder beneath that shell of shields with a garlic-scented mouth breather. We're in the same ID the Deities class, so later tonight we're going to quiz each other on the names and attributes of minor gods and goddesses. And now, I'm going to admit something I've avoided thinking about. Even though I'm surrounded by people wherever I go, I've been lonely here. But thanks to Janice, that's over now. Smiley face. Day 7. The Girl of My Dreams. Can't say I hadn't been warned. My first morning in the fourth, Layla had called me to a bunk for a here's what's what talk. She explained the different ranks within the Legion, Probatio, Legionnaire, Centurion, Praetor, and told me that I could leapfrog right to Legionnaire if I did some mega heroic unselfish deed. No pressure, she said, though it would boost the fourth's cred if I did. Then she went over Camp Jupiter's ground rules, stuff like no taking a giant eagle out for a joyride, no plotting to overthrow your praetor, no short-seating the senator's togas, no matter how hilarious a prank that might be. Punishments for rule-breaking range from extra chores to banishment to being sewn into a bag with angry weasels. That last one got a solid yikes from me. Finally, she warned me that probatios often have wild and crazy dreams after arriving at camp. Being plopped in the middle of ancient Rome's last remaining outpost and surrounded by godly influences, and maybe even the occasional god if Janice was right about them visiting New Rome, triggers the visions, they think. Sometimes the dreams are harmless, but other times they're horrible nightmares that warn of impending danger. So if I ever wake up screaming, Layla said, I should come find her, because the screams alone wouldn't be enough to alert her that something was wrong, apparently. My first nights here were mercifully nightmare-free. Tonight, though, well, I didn't wake up screaming, but my dream did have some uber-disturbing moments. Here's what I remember. A frizzy-haired girl, about my age, approached the Decumenian Gate, the camp's western entrance. Her ratty sneakers flapped with every step. Her threadbare dress hung like a filthy rag on her skinny 4-foot-nothing frame. She looked like a stiff breeze could knock her over, and yet something about her clenched teeth, the tightness around her dark, heavily lashed eyes, the fleet of flies buzzing around her head, made my dream self uneasy. When she reached the gate, Terminus, the god who guards our borders, popped up. I find Terminus fascinating. I mean, the guy is just a marble head and torso, no arms, no legs, and yet I swear he has a stick up his butt. He demanded to see her identification. But when she thrust her letter of recommendation at him, he drew back, shook his head violently, and refused to let her enter. A centurion of the fourth cohort arrived then. He wore the usual Roman gear, helmet, chainmail, leather arm and leg greaves, dagger, combat boots with piked cleats, sword, and, gods, I'm exhausted just writing it all down. Forget wearing it. I took the guy for a modern-day sentry until I saw his ripped jeans and the flannel shirt tied around his waist. Those fashion choices hinted at 90s grunge rock. But it wasn't until he removed his helmet that I knew I was glimpsing a scene from the past. Because the centurion was my dad. Not the guy I know and love, with his pudgy dad bod, dark brown hair, and nondescript clothes, but back when he was a high-ranking, scraggy teenage member of the 12th Legion Fulminata, with a cringy, bleached blonde cowlick, no less. He stepped forward and overruled Terminus. The god threw his non-existent arms up in disgust, while Dad beckoned the girl with a welcoming smile. That smile changed to alarm mixed with mild revulsion, the same expression he got the time he found a week-old pizza box festering under my bed, when the girl shoved her papers into his hand and pushed past him into camp. Eyes wide, Dad glanced at Terminus, who shot him a superior, "Told you so, look," before vanishing. The scene dissolved. New ones tumbled rapid-fire through my mind. The assembled legion stumbling back to let the girl pass, The Ore flinging food at her from across the mess hall, her bunkmates whispering about her behind their hands, Hannibal the elephant letting out an alarmed trumpet when she neared. The dream shifted again. Now Dad stood at attention before his praetors inside the Principia. The praetors asked him questions about the new girl. He shook his head and said he'd tried, he really had, but no one in the cohort could stand to be around her. Her presence was disrupting the Fourth's ability to work as a unit. Something needed to be done. The praetors looked grave, but nodded. The dream spun back to the barracks. It was after midnight, but the girl was out of bed. She had a tattered knapsack over one shoulder, and I knew instinctively she was running away. Before she sneaked outside, though, she tripped over a garbage can and kicked the rotting contents all over the barracks floor. Then she scowled. Not at her bunkmates. At me. At least that's what it seemed like. That's when I woke up. As soon as my heart stopped racing, I grabbed this journal and came here to my favorite latrine to ponder the dream's significance. It was weird seeing Dad at that age, and I was no fan of the girl's scowl. But overall, the dream didn't seem to foretell any danger. I mean, everything in it happened years ago. So, no reason to rouse Layla. Especially if, well, what if the dream was a different kind of warning? A warning that not every demigod or legacy finds a place at Camp Jupiter. I'm afraid that if I go to Layla, she might think I had the dream because I don't really belong here. So yeah, I'm gonna keep the dream to myself. After all, the fewer people who know about my dad's cowlick, the better. Day 8. A Thrilla on Aquila. Today was super fun, except for the near-death experience. It happened midway through the course, intro to elephants, unicorns, and giant eagles, which I'd signed up for because, well, elephants, unicorns, and giant eagles. A totally misleading description, BTW, as there is only one elephant here. Unless they're hiding a spare pachyderm somewhere. Possible, though not likely. I think. The class met at the stables, which are located uncomfortably close to the 5th cohort barracks. How those guys stand the stench is beyond me. Note to self, the 5th would be the perfect market for my spritz bottles of Bombilo's cafe scent. Eye-watering stink aside, the class was cool. I learned the proper technique for making medicinal unicorn shavings. Cheese grater applied gently to horn. I scrubbed Hannibal behind the ears with a sudsy push broom. If elephants could purr, his motor would have been rumbling overtime. I fed dead rats, probably the ones I'd collected earlier in the week, to hungry giant eagles. And I stepped in a catastrophic amount of poop. The elephants, unicorns, and giant eagles class should come with a no sandals warning. After my third encounter, I asked the instructors a two-part question. Whose job is it to clean up all this poop, and where does the poop go? Answer, here's a shovel and a compostable garbage bag. Use one to fill the other. Tie the bag up tight, and then get out of the way, pronto. Well, my pronto wasn't pronto enough, which is why I suddenly went airborne when a giant female eagle named Aquila, Latin for eagle, wonder which clever legionnaire named her, swooped in and snatched my poop bag in her talons. Full disclosure, I clung to that smelly sack as if my life depended on it. Actually, I'm pretty sure it did because, oh my gods, we flew high. Camp Jupiter disappeared in the distance, or where I guessed the camp was, because the mist, that magical force that shields our world from mortals, had disguised it as open hills and forests. I'm still learning to look through the mist, but when I squinted, I could just make out the little Tiber ribboning through the meadow and the lake at the foot of Temple Hill. We flew on, Aquila, the poop bag, and me, until a rolling expanse of rotting garbage, the local landfill, came into view. The eagle dove to deposit her load. The descent was like the worst kind of roller coaster ride. Full speed, straight down, no twists or turns, and the garbage odor was even worse than the stables. Ooh, another outlet for Bombilo's cafe scent. I scrambled up on Aquila's back to get my nose above the stink. Not a second too soon, either. A worker in a hard hat and a bright yellow safety vest emerged from her trailer. I flattened myself into the eagle's neck feathers just in case the mist wasn't working. I risked a peek when we took off, though. The worker had taken off her sunglasses, I couldn't see her eyes under her hard hat, but I could tell she was watching us. And she was smiling. Not a nice, thanks for the giant bag of poop, come again soon smile. A nasty, knowing smile that gave me the shivers. I couldn't get away from her and that landfill fast enough. Not that I was eager to go back to camp, because I figured I'd be in trouble. But my instructors were too relieved to see me in one piece to yell at me. Well, not too loudly or for too long, anyway. Here's the thing, though. I'd do it again. Not the poop bag flight or the landfill part, but the return journey. Because open-air soaring via Giant Eagle Express was amazing. And maybe I'm crazy, but I think Aquila liked having me along for the ride. That's how I interpreted the little beak nudge she gave me when I slipped off anyway. Sure, I'd get stuck with extra chores if I took her for an unauthorized flight, but honestly, it'd be worth it. Day 9. So not cool. Someone has been messing with my stuff, specifically with my Mercury action figure. Before Janice and I left to visit Temple Hill, I posed him like the statue in Great Granddad's Sanctuary, leaning casually against a post, ankles crossed, his sack of coins in one hand and his caduceus in the crook of his other elbow. But now, his legs are bent as if he's about to spring into action. One arm is raised overhead, his caduceus held like a spear. Posed like that, he doesn't look like Mercury anymore. He looks like a warrior. Almost like Mars. Minus the threatening snarl. And his coin purse is missing. I'm sure someone's just playing a prank on me, but still. I'm going to ask Janice if I should say something to our centurions. Later. I took Janice's advice and didn't bother Layla. I'm glad I didn't because I just found the coin purse tucked under my pillow. Inside was a slip of parchment paper with two words, Invenient MV, inside an oval with a squiggly bottom. No clue what that oval signifies, but I've got chills. Because the handwriting is the same as in my XII note. I know Invenient is Latin for find, and it's used when the thing to be found is male, which means MV is a boy or a man. But who is he? I don't know anyone here with those initials. Why am I supposed to look for him, and what am I supposed to do if and when I find him? And what, if anything, does the message have to do with XII or my Mercury figure being posed to look like Mars? Ah! Well, I guess the only one who can answer those questions is the mysterious MV. So tomorrow I start looking for him. Shouldn't take long. After all, there are only 200 of us in the Legion, and not all of us are male. Of course, if MV isn't a member of the 12th, it could be a while before I invenient him. Day 10. Claudia the Clumsy. Well, today has been totally awesome, she wrote sarcastically. I spent the morning asking if anyone knew who MV was. No luck, and when I started getting funny looks, I decided to backburner the investigation for the time being. Then this afternoon, I was trapped digging a trench with a chatterbox who spoke in question marks. My name is, like, Linda. I'm in the second cohort. My favorite store is the sandal shop. The only time she shut up was when I accidentally on purpose tossed a shovel full of dirt in her face. And then there was tonight, when I played in my first death ball match. Death ball! Like paintball, only with poison and acid and fireballs launched from a mini manuballista. Painful for all ages. It should have been exciting, especially since Janice and I came up with a totally boss strategy we called the Janice. Basically, we fired our projectiles while crouched back-to-back behind our scutum, which I kept calling sputum until Janice explained that one was a large curved shield and the other was wet mucusy stuff we cough up when we're sick. I probably won't confuse the two again. We looked like a two-headed, four-footed garbage bin shuffling around the field. But we withstood all attacks. Or we did, until I slipped on a loose death ball and fell in the trench I dug with question mark Linda. Janice escaped unscathed, but it was pretty much open season on me. My bruises will heal, but my scutum is dinged up worse than the hood of a car caught in a hailstorm. I'll have to take it to the forges to get the dents banged out. The icing on the cake? I twisted my ankle. So if the ambrosia and nectar don't heal it, people will now have a legit reason to call me Claudia the Clumsy. Day 11. Mess in the mess. Things were ugly in the mess hall this morning, and not just because an unprecedented number of Legionnaires stumbled in with serious bedhead. No, the trouble was because the food service was on the fritz. Instead of pancakes, bacon, and fruit, the wind spirits delivered nothing but hot, steamy oatmeal. Not a problem for me, but for the others? Yikes. Hangry Legionnaires were gearing up to storm the kitchens when a black raven, a.k.a. Praetor Frank, flew in and announced that donuts from Bombilo's were on the way. Much as I liked oatmeal, I wasn't going to pass up free donuts, so I headed outside to scrape my half-eaten bowl into a waste bin. That's when I spotted Elon standing on his tippy hooves and peeking in through a window. Fawns aren't allowed inside the mess hall, but they occasionally sneak in for a quick mouthful of tasty cutlery. Elon is a lot younger than the other fawns, though. His horns are barely noticeable, and the fur on his legs still looks baby fine, so I figured he was too intimidated to break the rules. I knew the Legionnaires would protest even more loudly if I gave him a precious donut, so I went over and offered him my oatmeal instead. Mistake. First off, the dude reeked like he'd been rolling in wet, slimy dumpster juice. Then he looked at my oatmeal as if it were Pergamentorum derelincere caeno. That's Latin for sewage sludge. I plan to hurl it at my enemy during the next war games. The phrase, not the actual sludge. And in case his disgusted expression didn't get the message across, he gave me a verbal slap, too. Elon doesn't need your leftovers. Elon gets the pick of the litter. I'm sorry, but anyone who refers to himself in the third person and brags about getting the choicest trash does not deserve my oatmeal, thank you very much. So I emptied my bowl and went back inside to the sad discovery that the last available donut was covered in coconut. Talk about Pergamentorum derelincere caeno. As bad as my morning was, it was nothing compared to what the Ore were going through. Usually they're invisible. But today, they were so agitated, they flickered like faulty light bulbs. That's how I realized the food service mix-up wasn't their doing. Which leads to these million denarius questions. What went wrong? What will we eat if the mess hall is still messed up at lunch? And finally, why would you ruin a perfectly good donut with coconut? Day 12. Two words. Air freshener. There comes a moment in every young Probatio's life when she realizes she should have peed before putting on her armor. For me, that moment came when I reached the top of the watchtower for my first shift on sentry duty. I tried to pay attention while my partner Julius, a seasoned legionnaire with three tattooed lines above his dad Mars's symbol, explained how to fire a mounted crossbow. But I was so seriously hydrated, I had to cut him off and request permission to use the facilities. He was very understanding. Not. I believe his exact words were, "Stop dancing from foot to foot and just go already." I'm pretty sure I set the camp record for racing down a flight of stairs while shedding armor. The nearest facility was a unisex single-seater that looked like a porta-poop portable toilet dressed up in marble tiles. To my horror, the little sign by the door handle read, "Occupied." A female voice inside confirmed that fact. "Mission accomplished," she crowed. Yeah, that was a weird thing to say in a bathroom, but I didn't care because it meant she was done and I'd reached the desperation point. And yet she still didn't come out. So after waiting a hot second, I pounded on the door and asked if she could please hurry up. I heard some shuffling, then the toilet flushed, the sign shifted to vacant, and the occupant emerged. Not a girl, not a boy either, but Elon. I'm sure I looked surprised because, well, I'd assumed Fawns used the great outdoors as their toilet. But judging from the stench that trailed out after him, no. I'd also assumed all Fawns were like Don, the Fawn who once tried to sweet-talk me out of denarii so he could buy donuts. But Elon just said two words. All yours. His high, reedy voice didn't sound anything like the one I'd heard. That led me to a third assumption. He hadn't been alone in the bathroom. But I was wrong a third time, because no one else came out, and when I stepped inside, the bathroom was empty. Well, except for some flies, and they didn't say anything except bzz, 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 while I did my bzz. My sentry partner just smirked when I told him about the mysterious female voice. Said Elon was probably meeting up with a water naiad who flushed herself away when I knocked. I wondered aloud where she ended up. And then I stopped wondering because I remembered the smell and gross. Thing is, I'm not sure my partner was right because the voice didn't sound girlish or flirty. It sounded raspy and triumphant. And Elon looked relieved, though not the way I did after I used the facilities. So now I'm wondering, what was that all about? Day 13. Bang on. Breakthrough. I found out who MV is. Or was. Or is it is. What's the proper way to refer to a ghost anyway? The source of my info was none other than Blaze, my rat-sacking aqueduct cleanout partner. He was on duty at the forges when I bought my scutum in for ding repair. Stepping into that workspace was like crawling inside an asthmatic dragon, all hot and humid with weird wheezing sounds. The only light source was the orange glow of the furnace until Blaze flicked a switch and a bank of harsh fluorescent overheads came on. Kind of fizzled the volcanic atmosphere, if I'm honest. I didn't think Blaze knew who I was. I mean, we're not in the same cohort, and we'd literally spent 30 seconds together on chore duty last week, so I was shocked when he greeted me by name. Of course, he could have just read it off my Probatio tag, but still, A for effort. He laid my shield on the work table and ran his fingers over it, his brow furrowed. When I asked if he could fix it, he made a face, duh, that's what I do. Then he picked up a little hammer and started banging away the dents. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to stick around until he finished, but I did because Blaze was such stimulating company. Ha! Wrong. I stuck around because I'd spotted the net of a Retiarius gladiator in need of a few replacement weights. Since it was already broken, I didn't see any harm in taking it for a spin. The problem with whirling a poorly weighted net inside a crowded space is that things get knocked over and tangled up and ever so slightly damaged. Whoops. One of the things I knocked over was an old leather-bound book filled with beautiful sketches of weapons and shields and armor. Blaze yelped when he saw me paging through it. Turns out the book is one of a kind and contains the life's work of an ancient master craftsman and demigod son of Vulcan, Memorius Vettorius, MV. I wasn't sure the craftsman was my MV until Blaze mentioned that Memorius is a ghost who usually hangs around the forges. That's when I realized the squiggly oval around the initials on my note looked a lot like the outline of a ghost. So if I'm right, and I sure hope I am because this is the only lead I've got, then I finally have MV's identity. What I don't have is his actual incorporeal presence. Blaze hasn't seen Memorius at the forges for over a week, which he says is weird because the ghost is always lurking around there. So MV is not only a dead guy, but a dead end unless I can track him down. And how the heck am I supposed to do that? The guy can appear and disappear at will. He could be anywhere. Blaze might be able to tell me about him, I suppose. He and Memorius are both Vulcan's sons, after all, which makes them half-brothers. Yikes, my head hurts just thinking about that. But after the mess my net twirling caused in the forges, I'm not sure I'm his favorite Probatio right now. In fact, I think he was adding dents to my scutum when I left. So for now, I'll forge on alone. Ha! Day 14. Oh, rats. When I heard the ear-piercing scream tonight, I figured someone in the fourth was having a nightmare of impending danger variety. Then I realized the shrieks weren't coming from the barracks, but from inside the bathhouse. For our safety, no one is supposed to be in the baths after 11 because there are no lifeguards on duty. Janice says the real reason the doors are locked is to thwart romantically inclined legionnaires from getting up to shenanigans in there. That thwarting can be thwarted, though, if you know the secret entrance to the main pool, which everybody does, although not many people use it, because you have to swim underwater through a narrow concrete pipe, then squeeze through a small mesh gate that leads into the pool. You'd better hope you're an underwater-breathing descendant of Neptune if you get stuck in there. Apparently, a girl and a boy from the first cohort thought the risk was worth it because they sneaked in via the not-so-secret entrance tonight. I'm thinking their lovey-dovey mood evaporated when they surfaced, though. Because dead rats. Hundreds of them. Floating in the pool, blocking the hot springs water supply, clogging the drains, even hanging from the basket used for towels. I can't imagine anything more totally, completely, scream-inducingly disgusting. And mysterious, too, because no one can explain how so many rats got in there so quickly. The filtration system is shut off when the baths close, so they weren't pumped in with the water. And the lifeguard swears the place was clean when he locked up at 11. The couple sneaked in around 11:15. Could someone have broken in and distributed all those rats in just 15 minutes? Didn't seem likely. We were all scratching our heads when it came out that the lifeguard, a member of the third, had a crush on the girl. The couple accused him of planting the rats to disrupt their date. The lifeguard denied it. The first rallied behind the young lovers and started blaming the lifeguard. The third jumped in and flung those accusations right back at the couple and then the whole first cohort. The first retaliated with venom. The verbal kind, not actual venom. At least, I don't think so. Things were escalating out of control when Frank and Raina showed up. They listened to both sides, deliberated for a few minutes, and then ordered the first and the third to clean up the mess together. I like thinking about Legionnaires from the first picking up dead rats because so many of them are, what's the best way to describe members of that cohort? Oh, yes, obnoxious jerks who think they're all that in a bag of chips. I feel bad for the lifeguard, though. The only thing he's guilty of is liking someone who didn't like him back. Hope that never happens to me. Day 15. Good old-fashioned book learning. It was a beautiful, sunshine-filled morning, right up until it started raining poop. Not on me, thank gods, because ick. I feel for the second, though. They were on shovel and bag duty at the stables, but the compostable sacks must have been defective. Every time the giant eagles went airborne with their loads, the plastic ripped open and, well, it wasn't a good time for those caught underneath, that's for sure. Or for anybody caught next to them afterward. Not even a spritz of Bumbilo's cafe scent could cut through that stink. On a more positive note, the Praetors have canceled this afternoon's marching practice while they look into the faulty bag issue, which frees up my schedule to Invenient MV. Later. No luck locating MV yet. But thanks to a visit to New Rome's University Library during my free time this afternoon, I know a ton more about Memorius Veturius. The library rivals some of the temples for architectural fabulousness. Sunlight streams into the main reading room through the oculus, the round skylight in the center of the gilded dome ceiling. Colorful tile mosaics of deities, famous Romans, and mythological creatures decorate the walls. One candlelit hallway is paved with stones engraved with the names of lost heroes. Some of those stones look worn and ancient, but others are brand new. Heroes who died in last summer's conflicts, I think. Here's to hoping no new stones are added for a long, long time. The library's shelves are chock full of scrolls and books. I'd probably still be searching the biography section, except the exact volume I needed, who made what, when, and for whom and why, ancient Roman craftsmen, literally fell into my hands. I swear I saw a dark-haired woman peeking at me through the empty space where the slim book had been. But when I blinked and looked again, she was gone. I took the book to a cozy window seat and flipped through the pages, looking for an entry on Memorius Veturius. It was so brief, I almost missed it. Here's what I found. Memorius Veturius was master craftsman to King Numa, the ruler who took over the throne after Romulus, Rome's founder, died. Numa was one of the good gods, famous for building temples, including one honoring Janus, Janus's dad, writing books of laws, and keeping peace in the kingdom for 43 years. Not too shabby. The gods apparently approved of Numa because at some point during his reign, they sent him an ornate cello-shaped shield called an ancile, along with this promise. So long as this ancile is safe, Rome will endure. Meaning, I guess, that if the ancile goes missing, Rome will go kaboom. That's where Memorius Veturius came in. King Numa instructed his craftsmen to make 11 identical copies of the ancile. That way, if someone tried to steal the ancile in order to destroy Rome, he'd have no clue which was the real one. The duplicates were so good that only Memorius himself knew which one the original was. But just to be extra safe, King Numa stashed the 12 uncalia in a temple only a crazy person would dare to defile. The Temple of Mars Ultor. I've been in Mars's temple, or the modern-day replica anyway. I saw a bunch of one-of-a-kind weapons in there, and an M made of 11 identical cello-shaped shields. 11, not 12, not XII. I'm thinking those 11 are Memorius' duplicates and that the original is hidden somewhere else in camp, because it must be here. Otherwise, Camp Jupiter, the living, breathing testament to Rome's endurance, wouldn't exist, right? I searched other books for info about Memorius, Numa, and the Ancyli. I mean, the more you know, right? But it came up empty, which makes me think that the legend is really obscure. Well, compared to the world-famous myths about the Olympians and celebrity heroes, anyway. That doesn't make it any less real, though. Just a lot less known. So the question is, if the original Ancyli exists, why isn't it in Mars's temple with the others? Or maybe it is. Maybe it just wasn't part of the M, and it's hanging on a different wall or locked away in a secret compartment or something. Only one way to find out. Pay another visit to my favorite god crypt. But not until tomorrow, because tonight I'm going to my first gladiator exhibition. Janice scored us seats in the Colosseum's blood splash zone. Scored me a cushion, too, because apparently those seats are as hard as, well, the concrete they're made of. The star of the show is the Mermillo champion, a swarthy bit of beefcake named Ricardo. If the posters plastered around camp are accurate, he sword fights wearing a teeny tiny loincloth, and not much else. I'm praying Mermillo is Latin for he who wears undergarments beneath his loincloth. Because if he falls down... Day 16. Games gone wild. I'm no expert, but I don't think that's how gladiator games are supposed to go. Last night's competition started out normally. The Colosseum was decked out with purple and gold banners and filled with cheering fans. The gladiators circled the arena, waving to the crowd, before stopping at the praetor's box to salute Reina and Frank. The praetors looked beat. Dealing with oatmeal fiascos and faulty poop bags can tire even the strongest among us, apparently. But they smiled and waved back in acknowledgement. Then the fights began. Swords clashed against shields, daggers stabbed into exposed flesh. The Lacquae Arii pinned arms with their lassos. The Rishi Arii wrapped heads with their weighted nets. And Ricardo the Mermillo champ revealed that, yes, he wears undergarments. It was a fabulous performance that rivaled the best World Wrestling Entertainment matches. I know what I'm talking about because Dad watches the WWE all the time. Made me a wee bit homesick thinking about him in his chair with the remote. Thank goodness that gob of blood splattered me in the face when it did, or else I might have gotten all weepy. The blood splash zone was out of wet wipes by then, so I excused myself to go down to the latrines to wash up. Which is how I almost got caught in the flood. Romans aren't known for their navy. A leaky rowboat and a couple tired-looking triremes are all Camp Jupiter has for ships. The naiads don't like it when we boat on the lake, so instead we flood the Colosseum and practice seafaring maneuvers, aka aimless drifting while trying to light cannons with wet matches, in 10 feet of water in the arena. Naval demonstrations weren't on last night's program, though. So why someone opened the Colosseum's floodgates is anybody's guess. Water gushed in, racing across the arena like a mini tidal wave and sweeping unsuspecting gladiators off their feet. Quick-thinking Colosseum workers saved the day by cranking open the drains. They saved the gladiators, too, at least the ones in heavy armor. If the water had gotten much deeper, there's no way those guys could have kept their heads above the surface. It was mayhem in the Colosseum until a shout cut through the noise. It was Praetor Reina. I thought she was awe-inspiring, in a terrifying way, before. But seeing her standing above the receding water, imperial gold dagger in hand, purple cape flapping in the wind, her warrior fierce glare turning her dark eyes even darker, I mean, wow. I'm glad I wasn't on the receiving end of her fury. Not that anybody was, not last night anyway. Her demands to know who had opened the floodgates were met with dead silence. Finally, she had no choice but to send us back to the barracks. She, Frank, and the Centurions spent today hunting for the culprit, but with no luck. Which sucks, because with all the weird stuff that's been going on, nerves are fraying in the ranks, and people are eyeing one another with suspicion. Day 17, target practice. All right, Just what is going on? First, the assembly horn wakes us up before dawn. We all stagger outside like well-trained zombies and form ranks. And then we get shot at. Not from enemies storming the earthen walls surrounding the camp, but from our own watchtower crossbows. The weapons usually point outward, but as we lurched into position, they suddenly spun 180 degrees and fired their arrows directly into camp. Is that any way to start the day? No. We would have fought back, but A, no one was manning the crossbows, so there was no one to fight back against, and B, only the most seasoned legionnaires had thought to grab their weapons when the horn blared. As if things weren't confusing enough, startled Lares kept materializing to see what all the commotion was about, and then dematerializing when they saw what all the commotion was about. So brave, those ancient purple spirits. The sentries finally got the crossbows under control, but only after the supply of arrows had run out. Thank the gods no one was seriously hurt, just some scrapes and bruises, and one twisted ankle. Mine again, all hail the return of Claudia the Clumsy. I hobbled to the infirmary with the other casualties, only to learn the medic's stores of ambrosia and nectar were missing. So now the medical staff is working overtime making more of both and other essential supplies, too. Pretty sure the unicorn's horns will be as thin as toothpicks by the time they're done being cheese gratered. Frank and Raina have canceled our usual activities so they can launch a full-scale investigation into all the troubles going on at camp. And I'm going to do a little investigating myself in the Temple of Mars Ultor. Later. Closed by order of Praetor Frank. That's a sign I found hanging on the massive iron door of Mars's temple. I've never heard of a temple being off-limits, but maybe Frank doesn't want whoever fired on us this morning to have access to Mars's weapon supply. When I couldn't go inside, I trooped all around the outside looking for a window to peek in, which is how I discovered Elon. He was curled up in a nest of trash behind the temple, clutching what looked like a lava lamp filled with blobby green goop. On closer inspection, not that close though, because I didn't want to wake him and because he still stank to high Olympus, the lava lamp was just an old glass soda bottle. The green stuff looked like swamp scum. Mmm, tasty. I don't know if fawns are allowed on Temple Hill, but he looked so cute all snuggled up in that trash that I left him alone with his bottle. Now I'm back in my bunk. I should be exhausted after playing Dodge the Arrow at the crack of dawn, but every time I close my eyes, I keep picturing that M shape made out of 11 shields, and I can't help wondering, where is number XII? Day 18. Probably not my best idea yet. I'm an idiot! There's only one place the original Ensile can be, the Principia. It's the most secure building in camp. The elite Praetorian guards protect the entrance to the headquarters. Get past them, and you have to deal with Reyna's vicious metal dogs, not to mention Reyna herself, who is even more ferocious. Frank seems pretty reasonable, but then again, he can turn into a lion and other intimidating creatures with claws and fangs. Plus, there's the Golden Eagle standard mounted behind the Praetor's desk, which Janice told me zaps laser beams from its eyes. So basically, the Ensile is out of my reach, which is totally fine. There's no reason I need to see it. Except, yeah, I really want to see it. I want to know for sure that it's safe and sound in the Principia. Too bad there's no way to sneak inside, not even to take a quick peek. Unless you happen to know about a secret ladder that leads from the aqueduct into the Principia, that is. And if you're descended from the god of thieves, well, that should give you a big advantage in the sneaking in department, right? Later. Oh my gods, they think it's me. Frank and Raina, they think I'm behind the troubles in camp. I overheard them talking from my hiding place on the ladder below the iron grate. The oatmeal, the dead rats, the faulty poop sacks, the malfunctioning crossbows, even the Colosseum flood, as they pieced together the incidents like tiles in a mosaic, they thought they could see a picture forming. A picture of me. I eat oatmeal. I got into the Principia with dead rats. I flew away with a bag of poop. I disappeared while on sentry duty and again during the gladiator games. In their eyes, the connections between me and the bizarre happenings are obvious. The timeline of the problems points to me too, they said. Before I arrived, Camp Jupiter was running smoothly. Afterward, not so much. And then there was my strange behavior, laughing hysterically at Frank after leaving Mars's temple, holing up in the fourth's latrine, scribbling in a notebook. What was in that notebook anyway? A list of future pranks? If so, they needed to confiscate it for the sake of the camp. Then they dropped the final bomb. I was a legacy of Mercury, god of tricksters. Probatios have been known to act out to get their godly ancestors' attention. It was possible, probable even, that I was pulling increasingly elaborate and dangerous pranks to gain Mercury's blessing. My heart was thudding so loudly by then, I can't believe they didn't hear it. I wanted to scale the ladder and burst through the iron grate to tell them they were dead wrong, that I loved being at Camp Jupiter and wouldn't do anything to jeopardize my place here or the safety of anyone who calls it home. But I couldn't, because there's no way they'd believe I was innocent. I mean, duh, I just made an unauthorized trek through the aqueducts to a secret entrance so I could spy inside the camp's headquarters for a hidden sacred item. And now I was eavesdropping on the Legion's highest authorities. Couldn't look guiltier if I tried. Reyna was ready to call me before the Senate then and there, but Frank, gods bless him, argued against confronting me, saying first they needed definite proof that I was behind the pranks. Reyna finally agreed, but I could tell she wasn't happy about it. So now I'm hunched in my bunk, trying not to cry. Because it totally sucks that the Praetors are suspicious of me, and it sucks that I can't let them know I know. No, the only way to earn their trust is to prove my innocence. That means ferreting out the real culprit. Reyna and Frank haven't been able to do that. But I'm holding mosaic tiles they don't know about. Those mysterious messages and my dream about a runaway misfit. Unless MV shows up or the Ansylee falls in my lap, the messages are a dead end for now. But I know just who to visit to dig up info on the girl of my dreams. Day 19. How to summon a god in 6 easy steps. At a time when nearly all the gods have gone silent, there's one deity you can always get to appear by simply stepping over the line. The Pomerian line, that is. The invisible boundary that encircles New Rome. Sure enough, the second I put a sandaled toe over that borderline, Terminus popped up. Behind him was his comrade with arms, an adorable little girl named Julia who handles all matters in need of hands for him. When I told him I wanted to ask him some questions, not cross the line, he flashed me an exasperated look and vanished. Julia disappeared with him. How that happens is a mystery for another time. Undeterred, I took a step back and then a step forward. Pop! Terminus and Julia reappeared. He took one look at me and yelled, "You again!" and disappeared with an irritated huff, and with Julia. I did the cha-cha to and fro again. "I can do this all day," I said when he materialized for the third time. "Fine," he grumbled. "What do you want to talk about?" "My dad," I answered, "and a little girl you didn't want to let into camp." "You didn't let a little girl into camp?" Julia looked wounded. "Why?" "Because reasons," he sniffed. "And I don't know who your dad is." Julia supplied the fingers for his air quotes. I told him my dad was a centurion here about 25 years ago. When that didn't jog his memory, I mentioned the bleached blonde cowlick. He gave a snort of derision. "That boy became your father? My sympathies." He narrowed his eyes. "You don't look like him. You look like your mother." My jaw dropped. A million questions flooded my brain, like, how does he know my mother? Did my parents meet here? Was my mom a demigod or a legacy or what? But right then, my focus had to be on my dream girl. "Why did you refuse to let that girl into camp?" Terminus's nose wrinkled. "Because she smelled like rotten eggs. Not her fault, I know, given who her godly parent was, but still." He shuddered in distaste and vanished. This time, I didn't summon him back. Instead, I returned to the barracks to think and write down what I'd learned. If the Praetors confiscate my journal, well, they'll see I was only trying to help. Here's what I now know. The girl was a demigod, the daughter of a god or goddess associated with the smell of rotten eggs. The stench traveled with her, apparently, and was bad enough to make my dad, the Legionnaires, and the Aure steer clear. Even gentle Hannibal couldn't stand it. The girl's parent wasn't an Olympian, because none of them had odoriferous attributes, although some say Juno stinks. A minor deity, then. I've consulted my ID the Deity textbook and come up with a list of two possibilities. Cloacina, the goddess of Cloaca Maxima, sewer system, and Mephides, goddess of noxious vapors that emanate from the earth. There are a couple of Cloacina's kids here at camp, and I've never heard anyone complain about them smelling like rotten eggs or any other bad odor. So, my Denarius is on Mephites. Day 20. Well, that stinks. Question. Assuming the malodorous demigod was Mephites' daughter, where would she go after she left Camp Jupiter? Answer. Someplace where her out-of-control body odor wouldn't offend anyone. A moment from my dream, when she tipped over the garbage can, points to one such place, the landfill. Can't do much better than that if you're looking to disguise your own stench. And I not only think she went there, I think she's still there. She's the worker, the one who stared at me in Aquila. She saw us through the mist, I'm sure of it. Which means she's a demigod. But if she's working and living at the dump, how can she be causing problems here? She can't be sneaking into camp, not if she's still as pungent as Terminus says she was. Someone would be sure to notice. Maybe she has an accomplice in camp, though I don't know who would help her. From what I saw, she didn't have much to offer besides recyclables, garbage, and... Oh. Oh my gods, I'm such an idiot! Because there is someone who would want that stuff! He even bragged about getting the pick of the litter. Elon. Later. Message to whoever left me those notes. Ego inveni MV. Translation? I found MV. But not Elon. He was gone when I returned to Mars' temple to look for him. His trash nest was still there, though. Buried beneath it was the glass bottle of swamp scum. Except it wasn't swamp scum. It was swamp gas. Mixed with the ghost of Mamurius Veturius. The smell that came out of that bottle when I opened it? Ye gods! Poor Mamurius was a bilious shade of green when he stagger-floated out. Luckily, once he was in the fresh air again, he returned to his normal off-white and odor-free state. He regained his ghostly strength, too. Then he told me this story. 3 weeks ago, I was floating around the forges when a young fawn, Elon, ran up to me. Ran through me, actually, which I did not appreciate. Prior Frank needs you, he bleated urgently. Said to meet him at the Temple of Mars Ultor right away. Come on! Frank was nowhere in sight when we arrived at the temple. Puzzled, I turned to question the fawn. Suddenly, I was overcome by noxious fumes. When I came to, I was trapped inside that bottle with those same fumes. They sapped me of my strength, rendering me powerless to escape. The fawn promised to free me, but only after I identified the original Ancyli from among the 12 mounted on the temple ceiling. I refused. I knew what would happen if that shield fell into the wrong hands. Better I be trapped in a bottle of stink forever than let the last outpost of ancient Rome fall. His vaporous shoulders slumped. Alas, my refusal only delayed the eventual outcome. His story ended then, and with a nod of gratitude for my part in saving him, he vanished. I'll check the forges later to make sure he's safe and sound with his brother Blaze. I started down the road out of Temple Hill, too. Then I backtracked and refilled Elon's bottle with scummy green water scoured from the bowl on Neptune's altar. You'd think one of the Big 12 would have something better than that pathetic blue tool shed. I put the bottle back in the trash nest where I'd found it. I hope it looks enough like Mamurius' toxic ghost to fool Elon. Because if he figures out someone's onto him, Camp Jupiter is going to self-destruct for sure. According to Mamurius' story, there should be 12 XII shields on the temple ceiling. But when I visited the God Crypt my second day at camp, there were only 11. Add that fact to Mamurius' statement about the outcome, and I come up with one conclusion. I was wrong about the original Ancyli being in the Principia. It was in Mars' temple with the others. Emphasis on was. So even without Mamurius' help, Elon somehow discovered which Ansylee was the original. By trial and error, maybe, sneaking them out of the camp one at a time, waiting to see if anything happened, then moving on to the next one when nothing did. Until finally, oatmeal. Or to quote the voice inside the bathroom, mission accomplished. Well, there's a new mission now, called Ansylee Recovery. Okay, that's a terrible name, but it's the best I've got until I think of a new one. And the name doesn't matter anyway. Accomplishing the mission does. Day 21. Quest party of three? Well, Blaze is in love with me. Ha, JK. But he has sworn to help me with my mission, my quest, as he says it should be called, because Mamurius told him all about how I freed him from the gassy bottle. Having a demigod ally with mad forging skills fits right in with my plan to retrieve the Ansylee, actually. So does having Janice for a bestie. I finally confided in her late last night. No surprise, she was more than ready to help save the camp. And New Rome, too, she pointed out, because if Camp Jupiter and the 12th Legion fell, the city wouldn't be far behind. I hadn't thought of that, but then my dad is safe in his suburb. Her mom isn't. Our only disagreement was whether to tell the Praetors what we discovered. After a hot debate, we were meeting in the forges because Mamurius wanted in on the plan and he refused to leave that workspace. I convinced them we should hold off going to Frank and Reyna until all the pieces of my plan were in place. That way, we could present the problem and the solution to them at the same time. When Blaze wondered aloud if my plan would even work, I pointed out that it includes stealth and booby traps, two of my specialties, so it was bound to succeed. Agreement reached. Work commences after lunch. After lunch. Welp, I'm in love with Blaze. Ha, JK. But I am in awe of how fast he crafted the two scutum garbage can I designed. It's based on the Janice strategy Janice came up with during Deathball. I just added the hinge to connect the two shields on one side and the interior latch to hold the two together. Much easier than trying to keep them in place while shuffling back to back. In addition to the Janice can, I stole two sacks of death balls, a Reciarius net, and a Laquiarius lasso from the armory. I retrieved the plumbata I'd launched into the Colosseum stands during my first weapons practice and added it to the other supplies in the compostable poop bag. And finally, Janice, Blaze, and I figured out how to bottle Bumbilo's bakery smell. I suppose I should thank Elon for proving it's possible to capture odors that way. And I will, right after I pin him to the wall with my plumbata. I'm on sentry duty tonight, so after dinner, I'll stash the bag by the aviary on my way to the watchtower. After dinner. Welp, Elon is in love with Mephitis' smelly daughter. Ha, JK. But he is terrified of Mimi. That's the demigod's name. Mimi. I learned all these facts by eavesdropping on their conversation inside the bathroom. I suspect she doesn't actually show up in there, but somehow speaks through the toilet, tapping into the noxious vapors that collect there, or some such. That's a lovely thought. Anyway, after leaving the supply sack hidden at the aviary, I took off for sentry duty. I didn't want to repeat my previous bladder blunder, so I veered to the bathroom for a quick pit stop. The same voices were murmuring inside again. I ducked behind a tree to listen in on their cozy toilet-side chat and was silently freaked out by what I heard. The day after tomorrow, Mimi is scheduled to work alone at the landfill's car crusher. She's going to bring the Ansylee and pulverize it in the machine. I wasn't the only one pushing the panic button at that news. I thought Elon was going to bleed himself hoarse. With good reason. He's a mythical creature born of ancient Rome. If ancient Rome ceases to exist, well, my guess is so does he and all his kind. Not sure he thought that went through when he signed on with Mimi. Or the fact that other species will vanish too, like the friendly dog-headed cynocephali, rowdy centaurs, naiads and dryads, and, oh my god, Bumbilo, the two-headed baker. No! The eradication of ancient Rome beings might not stop with mythical creatures either. Without the lingering aura of ancient Rome to bolster them, gods and goddesses could fade away too. The Olympians will probably be fine. That lot seems to survive everything thrown at them. It's the minor deities I'm afraid for. Janice says some of them are already so lost to the modern world's memory that they're hanging on by a thread. As usual, when tragedy strikes, the powerless and disenfranchised are the ones who suffer most. So that seals it. We will succeed in retrieving the anxiety if it's the last thing we do. We must. We can. We will. Day 22. Not so fast. Oh gods, I'm in deep, deep trouble. Like, way far down in Tartarus Town deep. My mind was spinning when I left the bathroom last night. Every nerve in my body screamed, "Do something!" So I found, aka bribed, someone to take my sentry duty and returned to the aviary. My idea? Fly Aquila on a reconnaissance mission over the dump, specifically to the car crusher, where I'd look for a way to shut it down or blow it up. Okay, not blow it up, but at least clog its work for a few days to buy Janice, Blaze, and me some time to finesse our plan. Aquila was dozing in her treetop nest when I slipped inside the eagle enclosure. I tried throwing pebbles at her to wake her up, but as my pitiful plumbata toss demonstrated during weapons practice, my arm and my aim aren't very good. So I started to climb. I got about halfway up when I heard a voice that chilled me to the bone. Not so fast. It was Reyna. I learned later she'd been following me ever since dinner, watching and waiting to catch me doing something I shouldn't be doing. Like ditching sentry duty and shinnying up a tree to steal a giant eagle for a joyride. I slowly climbed down, fully expecting Praetorian guards to clamp me in irons when I reached the ground. But Reyna was alone. Alone and very angry. "Explain yourself, Probatio. And know that if I don't like what I hear, I will drag you before the Senate in chains." I don't know what possessed me, I really don't, but instead of telling her the full story then and there, I said, "Not here, in the Principia. Just you, me, and Praetor Frank." I swallowed hard. "And your dogs." She blinked in surprise. Aurum and Argentum have a special talent. They can sense when someone is lying. Their other special talent is eating jelly beans. If their lie detectors go off, they attack the liar. So basically, I'd be a dead Probatio if I told even one little fib. Reyna agreed and ordered me confined to my bunk while she went to look for Frank. When she finds him, she'll summon me, and then I talk. May the gods bless me with a silver and truthful tongue. If not, great-granddad, if you're listening, get this message to my dad, okay? I love you, and I tried. Day 23. Going to the dogs. I'm still alive! Well, obviously. It wasn't easy telling the Praetors about the Ansaili, Elon, Mimi, and the messages, not with those dogs staring at me hungrily, Reyna's lips getting tighter and tighter, and Frank looking embarrassed and murmuring, "I never even noticed those shields in Dad's temple. Never heard of the Ansaili legend either." I got through it, though. Thought I was home free. Then Frank leaned over the desk and asked one question. "Does anyone else know about this?" My throat closed up with fear. No way I was going to pull Janice and Blaze into this, or Mamurius for that matter either. I already felt terrible for throwing Elon under the chariot. I mean, sure, the Fawn has an annoying habit of referring to himself in the third person, and his weakness for trash has brought us to the brink of destruction. Put those things aside, though, and he's just a scared little kid with a soda tab necklace. When I hesitated, Frank repeated his question. I had to choose then. Rope my friends into this mess with me, or lie and die? Reyna saved me. Even as I write these words, I still can't believe it. But she did. She held up her hand to signal me to stay quiet, then called out, "Bring them in!" Praetorian guards led Janice and Blaze inside. Mamurius drifted in after them. Frank explained that the three of them had come to him when they heard I had been confined to my bunk. Word gets around fast about that sort of stuff, apparently. They told him all they knew before I got there. They'd also outlined the plan I had proposed for dealing with Mimi and getting the Ansaili back. While Frank was talking, Reyna studied me, and continued to study me after he finished. Then, to my astonishment, she smiled. "Your loyalty to your friends is admirable, Claudia. Your forthright truthfulness, too. though it's a little late in coming. She sat back and steepled her fingers. Now then, about your plan to deal with Mimi, I have one change to make to it. She nodded toward Frank. Instead of endangering Aquila, Frank will fly you and your supplies to the landfill. Agreed? The idea of boarding Air Praetor wasn't hugely appealing. It still isn't. But I was in no position to argue, and she was in no mood to debate. Agreed. So now I'm back in my bunk yet again. My fellow legionnaires are whispering about me because they think I'm still in trouble. But I'm just waiting for nightfall and praying that the first part of my plan is going to go off without a hitch. Because we have just one shot to get this right. If we fail, the Ancile is history, and so are Camp Jupiter, New Rome, and all ancient Roman creatures, great and small. If we succeed, though, we'll get in, get out, and be back in time for breakfast. For the sake of the 12th Legion Fulminata, I hope it's not oatmeal. Day 24. Exploding poop bags and spritz bottles, anyone? Right. Here's how it was supposed to go yesterday. Frank the Giant Eagle was to transport a poop-free compostable garbage bag filled with death balls, the Janus can, the Richiarius net, and the Lacwearius lasso to the landfill. What actually happened? Frank the Giant Eagle crash-landed while transporting what he thought was a poop-free compostable garbage bag filled with the aforementioned items, but which upon impact was discovered to contain nothing but poop. And a single death ball, which Hannibal's handler suspects Hannibal ingested by mistake. Ick. While Frank visited the infirmary to get his broken wing, arm repaired, Blaze, Janice, and I scrapped our original concept and improvised. Under cover of darkness and armed with spritz bottles of Bombilo's Cafe scent, we lugged death balls, the Janus can, and the other weapons through secret tunnels, over the hills, and through the woods to the landfill. No one thought to tell us that Reyna had access to a truck. Not that any of us can drive, but still. I dreaded the hike because I knew the others would look to me, the descendant of the god of travelers, to steer them in the right direction, and frankly, after my aqueduct wanderings, I wasn't sure I was up to the task. Fortunately, we got an unexpected guide for our journey. Elon. Mamurius had tracked down the Faun soon after leaving the Principia. He promised slash threatened to make whatever remained of Elon's life a living underworld if he didn't help us. Elon was more than happy to lend a hoof since it meant stopping Mimi. He knew the way, too, since he'd been traveling to and from the landfill to feast on trash for days. As an added bonus, as we hiked, we convinced him to stop referring to himself in the third person. Win-win! When we reached the edge of the landfill, we changed into our disguises, hard hats and bright yellow safety vests. If anyone questioned us, we'd say we were workers on the night shift. No clue if the landfill has a night shift, but it was the best we could come up with on short notice. We sent Elon back to camp with a message for the Praetors and a spare bottle of Bombilo's, which he was happily drinking when I looked back. Then crept over the mountains of wet, slimy garbage towards Mimi's trailer. Worst hike ever. We reached the trailer without incident. As quickly and quietly as we could, we went to work setting the booby traps. We hung the weighted net over the doorway and planted a sea of death balls on the steps. We dug a trench in the trash just beyond the stairs and built an arch made of recyclables above it. When Janice had attached the lasso to the keystone, we took up our positions. Janice and Blaze tucked inside the protection of the Janus can with the rope and me on the trailer roof above the net. I gave Blaze the go-ahead nod. He threw a rock at the trailer door and quickly crouched back down inside the can. I held my breath. Moments passed. Then a light came on inside the trailer. The door opened. A woman emerged. A woman and the most unbelievable stench, like the inside of an old milk carton mixed with moldering gym clothes all doused in a skunk spray. Ladies and gentlemen, Mimi had left the building. It was time to act. I released the net. It dropped over Mimi's head and wrapped her up like a used Christmas tree. She let out a howl and lurched onto the steps. Her feet hit death balls. She skated, slipped, and sprawled straight into the trench. Janice yanked the pull rope. The keystone popped free, and in one glorious cascade, the arch and all the trash piled up around it fell on top of Mimi. I swung from the roof through the open door into the trailer. I tore through closets and looked under the bed. Nothing. I pulled open drawers and checked the shower stall. Still, nothing. I spun in circles, desperately searching for the Ancile or something, anything that would point to its whereabouts. I almost missed it. Lying horizontal at waist height and covered by a length of purple fabric, it looked like an ironing board. But when I whisked the fabric away, there it was, the missing shield. I snatched it up, carefully, and raced outside to find Janice and Blaze madly spritzing a moving mound of garbage with Bombilo's cafe scent. The mouthwatering odor held her at bay just long enough for reinforcements to reach us. Aquila, Frank, and the other giant eagle swooped in, caught us in their talons, and flew us off into the moonlight. Camp Jupiter had never looked so splendid. And the baths? Ugh, pure heaven. Day 25. The end. JK. I've been thinking a lot about secrets. Me and my messages and dream. The identity of the one true Ancile. Elon's wackadoodle relationship with Mimi. Would our situation have gotten so out of control if people had opened up and shared what they knew sooner? Maybe. But mostly, I've been thinking about a new secret I learned today. I was in New Rome, on my way to the library, where a new but old paving stone was going to be laid. The name etched on the paver? Memorius Veturius. He wasn't recognized as a hero in his lifetime, but he sure helped save the day and ours. I was killing some time before the ceremony by wandering the streets. Janice had offered to go with me. Blaze, too. He turned as red as a forge fire when he mumbled it, which makes me wonder if maybe he is in love with me after all. Well, plenty of time for that sort of thing now that Camp Jupiter is safe. I told them both thanks, but no thanks. I wanted to explore New Rome on my own this time. To drink in the sights, sounds, and, yep, smells, without any distractions. To imagine my father walking these same cobblestone streets. I had no route in mind. I just let my feet take me where they would. They steered me to a place I've never been before, yet it was as familiar as the back of my hand. A doorway to a modest home tucked on a side street. There was nothing unusual about it. It looked just like every other front door on that street. Except it was open. And leaning against the frame was a woman with dark wavy hair, like mine. Dark eyes, like mine. The big nose, like mine. Her hand drifted to her stomach and rested there. And then she smiled at me. "Hello, Claudia." Her voice was soft and high, with just the hint of a squeak. I froze in my tracks, speechless. Then I cleared my throat. Mom? Her smile widened. She pushed off the doorframe and moved toward me. Took my hands in hers. "My name is Cardia. Cardi, to you and your father." "The goddess of threshold and hinges," I murmured. "Thank you, ID the deity class." She nodded. "I've been allowed to contact you in this form because of what you did to save our world. Without you and your friends, well, we minor deities," Julia would have been proud of my mom's mad air quote skills, "might not be here." "In this form," I repeated. "Meaning you've contacted me in other ways?" I gave myself a mental head slap. "The messages, they were from you, not great-granddad?" She seesawed her hand in a maybe, maybe not gesture. "I wrote them, yes. But I couldn't have delivered them. Not without his help." I nodded my understanding, remembering what Layla had said about the recent problems with communications. "Still, if you knew what was going on with the Ancile and everything, why didn't you or the other gods intervene to stop Mimi?" Her lovely face clouded over. "Because reasons," she said softly. Raina told me later that gods and goddesses don't appreciate it when other deities muck about in their children's affairs. Doesn't stop them from doing it all the time, of course. And at least my mom had done what she could to help. Cardia's form started to flicker then. "My time here is almost up. Hold out your arm, quickly." I did as she requested. "This is supposed to be done in the forum before the Senate and the Legion. but they're a little busy right now, so... She met my eyes apologetically. Close your eyes. This might hurt. It did hurt. A lot, in fact. A searing pain like when you brush against a hot stove, only a billion times worse. It was over quickly, though. And when I opened my eyes, I saw what had caused the burning sensation. There were now 4 tattoos on my forearm. A hinge, a caduceus, a single stripe, and the letters SPQR. Mom traced her fingers over the images, a touch so feather light I wouldn't have felt it if I hadn't seen her hand. And then her form faded away, and I was left with just her soft whisper in my ear, "Sinatus populusque Romanus." I saluted the sky. SPQR, Mom. SPQR forever. This is Erin Cahill. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Trials of Apollo, Camp Jupiter Classified, A Probatio's Journal by Rick Riordan. This program was produced and directed by Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2020 by Rick Riordan. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.